Wrinklebronia, let the chant begin. Wrinklebronia, let's hear it again. Wrinklebronia, this show's on fire. With Evan Roberts, we're taking it higher. Wrinklebronia, oh, Wrinklebronia, yeah. Wrinklebronia, let's go. Wrinklebronia, let's run the show.
A sweep edition of the Wrinklebronia. It's okay, Met fans. It's okay to smile. It's okay to be happy. That doesn't mean we think they're winning the World Series. It doesn't mean we think they're about to go on an 18-game winning streak. It is okay to actually enjoy a 4-game winning streak. And it's actually okay to enjoy wins that are actually easy. We did a Rico. It was episode number 700. If you missed it, you could check it out in the archives. It was a drive-home edition of the Rico after the Mets won on Friday. And I mentioned that while it was great to win, it feels like this season wins come at like a cost. Either guys get hurt or the team plays incredibly bad and you walk away from a victory and you don't feel great about yourself. That's kind of been the story, if you will, of 2026, where the wins feel lucky. The wins feel fortunate. They don't play great baseball necessarily. And you take your win, but you're like, this team ain't very good. And while I'm not going to tell you after 2 wins on Saturday and Sunday against the Marlins, this team is great, I'll tell you that these were easy. Like, these were the kinds of wins that they really haven't had this season. The kinds of wins in which they scored a lot of runs, they got clutch hits, they played well, and things felt good. Do you agree, Hoff? You kind of have that sense. You feel good about these victories. Even you feel good about these victories, right, Pete?
Oh yeah, I'm very ecstatic about them. No, these were good. You can't knock them. You can't. This is what they're supposed to be doing. They're supposed to be beating up on bad teams, and it finally happened.
There you go. See, that was nice because I thought you were about to start by being a jerk and saying, we suck. This is that. Look, the Mets still may suck. We are many games under 500. And the one thing I want to make very clear on some of these episodes of the Rico when we're doing it every other day, it's okay to say good things about this team. It's okay to say they played well. It's okay to say Marcus Semien had an awesome weekend. You can say that without it being like a complete reiterating of the debate of Brandon Nimmo for Marcus Semien. It's okay. It's okay to say, hey, I love the way this team played this weekend. That doesn't mean they're going to Seattle and winning 3 straight. That doesn't mean they're about to go on this West Coast trip and win 5 out of 6 games. So before we dive into details on Game 2 and Game 3 of this series, and we hand out the Rico, I'm the man right now, and the net negative, and we read your emails, understand that it's okay. It is okay to be happy with when your team wins. That doesn't mean you're apologizing to David Stearns. It doesn't mean you love this roster. It doesn't mean you think this team's going to go on a run. We all hope they do. Obviously, if you're a fan, you'd rather be wrong and happy than right and miserable. I think that's the old phrase I've used many, many times. But this was a good weekend, and it's okay to say that. So I want to start with that. It is okay to be happy that the New York Mets over 2 days against the Miami Marlins outscored them 16-2. That's good. That's a good thing, especially after the wretched baseball we saw down in Miami a week ago and after what happened on Monday and what happened on Tuesday. And that is probably the most encouraging thing that's happened. When you think about all the pitfalls of this season, and there's been plenty of them, I'd argue that maybe the most comatose that we have been is after Tuesday's second consecutive 7-2 loss to the Cincinnati Reds. Because you're now talking about a 5-game losing streak. Al Dukes even said on the Fan, I hope they lose 12 in a row again. And it felt like, all right, this is where they let go of the rope. And this is where things get even uglier than they've already been. And they responded. I mean, it wasn't the most impressive thing in the world on Wednesday and then Friday, but they've responded at least with a 4-game winning streak. And here's what they've done. While I don't think this team is any good, and I don't think they're going on any kind of massive run, they have at least extended our period of hope. Now, as far as these 2 games are concerned, let's start with Saturday's game, late Saturday afternoon against the Miami Marlins. The Hall of Fame induction ceremonies were very, very nice. It was good to see Bobby Valentine, the manager I trust the most, getting inducted into the Mets Hall of Fame. I want to address that right off the top before we get into the game, because there were a few emails I got. In fact, I'll read one of them to be specific, if I could find my phone where I save all these emails. Oh, wait, did I lose that? Oh, no, I got it right here. There was some criticisms over Lee Mazzilli. Nothing he said specifically, but about, hey, is that guy really a Hall of Famer? Now, I want to remind you, it's the Mets Hall of Fame. Okay, this is not Cooperstown. This is not the same standards necessarily that you would have if we're talking about the actual baseball Hall of Fame. This is a Mets Hall of Fame. This is about honoring the history of this franchise. And so we don't need to hold it to the exact same standard necessarily that we have for the baseball Hall of Fame. But Bobby Valentine, I'll start with him, is a well-deserved Mets Hall of Famer because he was the manager of a team that I think gave a lot of us joy. If you're over the age of, I guess you'd have to be 35 or older, Bobby Valentine was the guy who I almost thought was the face of the Met turnaround. Because when the Mets were really, really bad in 92 and 93, and even the strike year of 94, 95, Bobby Valentine took over late in the 1996 season. And I remember when he took over, I didn't know that much about him. It was new to me. And the Mets started to turn around in 97. They had a great year. They won 88 games. And then in 98, they won 88 games, but collapsed at the end of the year. And then 99, we all know, they get to the NLCS, 2000, the World Series. And a lot of the roster changed. I'd say Edgardo Alfonso was probably the main face of consistency over that period of time. But Todd Hundley was there, and then he was gone. Mike Piazza wasn't there, and then he came. Al Leiter wasn't there, then he came. Johnny Franco, obviously, another one who's the face. So I'd say Franco and Alfonso were the faces in terms of players, but Bobby was the manager face during that transition. And I believe, with all due respect to the players on that roster, to Piazza, to Olerud Denzil, to Robin Ventura, I believe Bobby Valentine got more out of that team than the talent actually was. And so, to me, that's a no-brainer Met Hall of Famer. Like, the late 90s teams has a handful of guys that should be honored. Al Leiter a few years ago, well-deserved. We know about Mike Piazza, Edgardo Alfonso. And the manager, the architect of that in many ways, was Bobby Valentine. But I got an email from, he actually didn't even sign his name. I guess the email is B. Dierick, who writes, I hate having to preface this, but I feel like I have to. Lee Mazzilli was a good Met. He had some solid seasons and was part of a championship team. He was also part of some mediocre teams and was at best an above-average player. He has a 12.4 WAR in his Mets career. Juan Lagares had a 12.3 WAR in his Mets career. Nothing against either player, but should this be the standard for the Mets Hall of Fame? I get it's not nearly the honor that getting a number retired is, but there should be a higher standard. Granted, I'm not old enough to have watched him, so this opinion is based solely on Baseball Reference and Mets lore and vibes. Also, Bobby V doesn't exactly have a stellar resume either, but being the manager of a pennant-winning team is enough. Let's go, Mets. So, I'm not old enough to remember Lee Mazzilli as a player either. And that's why the first thing I said was, this is not the Baseball Hall of Fame. This is not about stats. This is not about, okay, he hit this benchmark. He needs to be a Met Hall of Famer. What I know about Lee Mazzilli, and you heard it during the speech and the video about him, is the same thing my dad told me and I heard from Joe B and others about him, which is that you are talking about a local kid, let's start with that, a Brooklyn kid, who was a huge prospect, who was the face of a bad era in Mets history. And it's not his fault that the Mets were bad, but he was the face. He was the matinee idol. He was the guy that got the ass from a lot of the women watching, kind of like what Derek Jeter got many years later. And so it's not about stats. It's not about success, though he did come back for the 86 team. It's about that. I mean, and I think that's enough when you're talking about a team Hall of Fame. So it's not about numbers. It's not about what his WAR is. If you get into the weeds on that, then fine. But I think it is about being the face and the reason to go to the ballpark in an era that was really, really bad. I don't have like another great comp for it. Like, actually, you know what? I think I do, if you want to go back a decade later. And it's not a perfect comp. I want to warn you about that. But Todd Hundley was a homegrown guy and for a few years was the face of a bad Mets team. And if you were going to the ballpark, you at least got to see the switch hitting catcher hit a lot of home runs. I think his story kind of got derailed by everything that happened with Piazza and his injury before that. And so Todd Hundley's almost become a forgotten Met. But Todd Hundley was a face of some bad teams. And if the Mets ever decided to induct Todd Hundley into the Mets Hall of Fame, I would totally respect it, and I would understand it as someone who watched him play. So that's my explanation for Lee Mazzilli, but I thought it was very cool. I always love when they honor the history of this franchise. Steve Cohen was announced, and his reaction was pretty mixed. Like, he didn't get the John Mara boos from a couple of years ago, but there was definitely some Met fans who unleashed some boos for Bobby Valentine. For Steve Cohen. Bobby V got all cheers. And as I mentioned on our last episode of the Rico, the 700th edition, love the Bobby Valentine disguise giveaway. Anyhow, let's get to the game. Number one, we'll start with Christian Scott. Christian Scott continues to be very impressive for this team. And, you know, he comes into this start also looking for his first major league win. He gets helped out a little bit on the Hayden Singer caught stealing of Jacob Marcy in the second inning. And he was helped out by some good defense. Carson Benj made a really good running catch to end the third with a couple of guys on base. He made another great catch to start the fourth inning. And then really, A.J. Ewing put his mark on the game when he made the catch that secured Christian Scott's performance. Because in that fifth inning, with two men on base, I guess it was one guy on base, but a run in at 3-1, he was allowed to face Otto Lopez. His pitch count in the 90s, it was at 93 at the time. And I know you don't want to think about wins. You don't want to overthink about wins. But I think that after he gave up the base hit to Liam Hicks, this was going to be Christian Scott's final hitter, especially holding on to that 3-1 lead. And it was about the outfield defense. It was about A.J. Ewing making a really good running catch that he got a great jump on. What you saw in game two was the defense of the youngins. Both Benj and Ewing made really important defensive plays that changed the entire complexion of Christian Scott's outing. I think every start by Christian Scott has almost been very similar. There are at-bats and moments where his stuff is electric, and he strikes guys out and has these little pockets of dominance, but then he gets himself into trouble. And the real key is, can you make the big pitch in the biggest of moments? In Scott's case, most of the big pitches he made came with the caveat that it was a great defensive play backing him up. But at the end of the day, five innings, one run from Christian Scott, and the Met offense was able to do something. It didn't start off great against Tyler Phillips, and the third inning was like the epitome of bad Met baseball when you get a leadoff double by Marcus Semien, and then we see the back-to-back bunts of Vidal Brujan and Hayden Sanger. So here's where I stand on the back-to-back bunts. When Marcus Semien leads off with a double, and you've got Vidal Brujan as your eighth place hitter, followed by Hayden Sanger as your ninth place hitter, I'm not a fan of bunting. Because if you're Vidal Brujan, you've either got to just drive him in, and worst case scenario, sure, you could advance him with a ground ball to the right side. But by laying down a bunt, obviously if you're bunting for a hit, it's a little bit different. But by laying down a bunt, you're passing that baton willingly to a guy who has not hit yet in the major leagues. So the bunt by Brujan I didn't love. Now, he was given a break because the third baseman, Leo Jimenez, made a bad throw. And so instead of it being a sacrifice runner on third, one out, but you're bunting for the ninth place hitter, it turns into first and third and nobody out. Hayden Sanger comes up. Now, I'm big on bunting with Hayden Sanger. I think I've said that a lot, that I would almost treat the catcher spot, even with Luis Torrens occasionally, I would treat it almost as a pitcher spot. But with first and third and nobody out, I don't like that. Because now they did a safety squeeze. Sometimes you would see a bunt to just advance the runner on first to second and go second and third, one out, which I hate too. But I view this at bat for Sanger like this. If in the worst case scenario, he hits a ground ball double play, at least I get a run in. That's literally how I'm viewing it. If he strikes out, okay, at least Carson Benj has an opportunity to drive a run in. But what am I? I'm trying to safety squeeze with a guy at third base that's not the fastest in Marcus Semien? I just didn't like it. Now, it's odd to see back-to-back bunts. When do you ever see that? And I thought that that play was really on Semien, who should have seen. It's a safety squeeze for a reason. It's not a suicide squeeze. You have to read the bunt and see if you have a chance to score. He had no chance to score. The bunt was right to the first baseman, Christopher Morel. So I didn't like the bunt. I assume it came from the dugout. Let Senger swing. And that's before I knew Hayden Senger was going to hit a home run three innings later, which none of us saw coming. But I viewed that at bat as, you know what? If in the worst case scenario, you're bouncing into a double play, it's obviously not the worst case scenario because I'm getting a run out of it. And I'll take a run. It's the bottom of the fourth inning. It's 0-0. I haven't scratched anything out. And when I get a runner on second and nobody out, I don't give a crap who's coming up in the batting order. If I have a runner on second and nobody out, I have to score that run. That run needs to score. And it turned into a disaster based on the bunt to first base and then the easy out at home of Marcus Semien. And then for some reason, to make this inning even more of a cluster bleep, Vidal Brujan's trying to steal third base, which I have no idea why. What? Just let, you've got your top of the order now up in Carson Bench, Bo Bichette, and Juan Soto. Let him hit. You got 2-1 and one out. You're giving your, in theory, best hitters two opportunities to drive that run in. What you can't do is run yourself out of the inning. So through three innings, you're probably thinking to yourself, oh, this is the same crap. This is just bad Met baseball. But what we saw in the fourth inning, and it would continue throughout this game, was the Mets actually tacking on and scoring runs. The fourth inning started with a great at-bat by Juan Soto drawing a walk, a base hit by Jared Young, who I am forming a like of Jared Young. I know I've mocked him plenty and criticized Carlos Mendoza plenty for his love affair for him. I don't know, maybe being away from Jared Young has caused an appreciation, or maybe watching all the crap attempts at DH per people since Young's been out and since this Met roster has been constructed the way it's been constructed, with Polanco out and Robert Jr. out and all this crap, Lindor out, Mauricio out, Alvarez out. Maybe it's forced me to look at Jared Young and say, oh, he's not that bad. He delivers a base hit, and then Mark Vientos actually delivered the biggest hit of this game. Mark Vientos, who is such a sink and swim hitter for this team at this point, rips the two-run double into the left field corner, which felt like it changed the trajectory of this game. Because in the bottom of the fourth inning in this moment, with Christian Scott surviving the four innings, backed up by good defense, with running into outs in the third inning, it felt like a typical, like, ugly Met game. And I thought Mark Vientos's two-run double really changed that. Really changed the look of this game. And then Marcus Semien came in with a two-out RBI single. Marcus Semien had a tremendous series. More on him later. He is certainly a prime candidate for the Rico I'm the Man Right Now star of the series. But what was very important is, because if you go back to Friday's game, the Marlins seemed to respond almost every time the Mets scored runs. They jump out to a 4-0 lead. They come back a few innings later. They make it 4-1. Mets make it 5-1. Marlins make it 5-2. Mets answer with a run at 6-2. Marlins score two runs to make it 6-4. So it was a lot of risk. Even when they scored that insurance run in the bottom of the seventh that gave them a two-run lead on the sac fly by Melendez, the next inning, the Marlins get the two-run home run by Owen Casey to tie the game. So there was a lot of non-shutdown innings by Met starters and Met pitchers in general. So I thought the fifth, after they got those three runs, was going to be a really big inning for Scott. And I obviously gave up the RBI hit to Liam Hicks ahead of the count. Another example of that. But he was able to get through that inning. And then we saw this Met bullpen do just an outstanding job. Very quietly, this Met bullpen has become like a, dare I say, strength of this team. You get Cionel Perez, who they just called up because they had to send Tobias Myers down. A few more minutes on that later, because that was a weird decision we'll discuss. But he comes in as one of the Syracuse shuttle candidates and delivers a 1-2-3 inning. Waskar Brazoban comes in and dominates and strikes out the side. Austin Warren puts himself into trouble by putting the first two guys on base and then gets right through the inning. Does a great job. And luckily, the Mets were able to bust this game open with the home run by Jared Young in the sixth, the home run by Hayden Senger in the seventh, the RBI single by Juan Soto in the seventh. And so that was the other great part. They made the bullpen's job a little bit easier because this offense, after struggling early, puts up the three in the fourth, puts a run up on the board in the sixth on the home run by Young, And then tacks on the two in the seventh inning. So at least this bullpen, which has been used a lot when you go back to Friday and the lack of availability of Devin Williams and how Brooks really was not supposed to be available, but then comes in and gets a big out. So, you know, he's not available for this game. Their bullpen was in such disarray that Tobias Myers was literally sent down for no reason. No reason. I mean, he was sent down because he has options. That was it. That was the reason, actually. Let me clarify. There was a reason. That was the reason. Wasn't because he's pitching badly. And he hasn't been great recently. It's not even to stretch him out as a starter, which we've talked a lot about and should be under consideration. They literally sent him down because Freddy Peralta couldn't get through five innings, and the Mets had to go through so much of their bullpen on Friday that in order to get themselves a fresh body, which they desperately needed in Cyanel Perez, who did a great job, they need to send somebody down. And it's a numbers game. You know, we go through this all the time, especially early in the season or in spring training with who's going to make the team and who's not going to make the team. If you have options, get your bags packed. You know who has options too? And they're not going to send them down because I think he's on such a different level right now. And that's actually Waskar Brazoban. He's the other guy who has options, but they could not do that. And remember, when you send a guy down, it's not as simple as, oh, just call him back in a few days. No, he's down there for 2 weeks. Unless there's an injury. That's the caveat. So maybe the Mets can make up an injury. They could certainly do that. They could say, hey, Cyanel Perez, something wrong with your pinky? You got the Mitchell Robinson? No problem. Go on the IL. You do that, then Tobias Myers could come back. But overall, this was a good win. This was a nice win. This was a, you know what it was? It was a stress-free win. Because once they started tacking on the runs in the sixth and seventh inning, you were able to put your feet back and enjoy it. And it was really, and go through this, go through the Met wins, which you can count on one hand recently. They've all been stressful. Hear me out on this. So before Saturday's game, they went on Friday 9-7 on a walk-off in the 10th. They beat the Reds 4-2. Their last win before that was the game against the Nationals on Thursday afternoon in Washington. They went 2-1. The last win before that was, yes, 16-7, but that was the 12-inning game. That was a crazy game in which they could have lost 15 different ways. Win before that, 7-6 against the Yankees. Win before that, 6-3 against the Yankees. Win before that was the Tigers, 9-4. So I guess that was the last time they won a game fairly easily. And they were down in that game. They were down 3-0. They took the lead in the fifth. They tacked on runs late. So even that game wasn't exactly the easiest game to win. 3-2 in 10, and then go back to the opener against the Tigers on May 12th. They won 10-2. So the moral of this story is, A, the Mets don't win a lot, and when they do, it's not easy. That's the point. So to get an easy win on Saturday was very, very nice. The game on Sunday afternoon, same thing. I mean, really the same thing. And I know they had to do it because the Marlins were in this weird spot where their starting pitcher, Jensen Junk, got hurt, and so they had to use a real bullpen game. So you're facing John King, a left-handed reliever making his first major league start in a cavalcade of bullpen arms. So there's no excuse to not take advantage of that. But if you've watched the 2026 Mets, and if you're listening to the Rico Bronya in late May, early June, with this team 7 games under .500, I assume you either have nothing going on in your life or you're a diehard Met fan watching every game. And if you've watched every game, you know they could have made the Miami Marlin bullpen look like the Nasty Boys in their prime. That was a possibility. So you get the tone-setting home run by Carson Bench to get them an early lead. You get the Marcus Semien two-run home run on the very first pitch he sees from Anthony Bender. You get the clutch two-out rally in the fourth inning. This was my favorite. Two outs and nobody on in a game that's now close at 3-1. A two-out walk by A.J. Ewing, little blooper by Brett Beatty, long at-bat by Semien drawing a walk, and then Torrens pokes through a two-run single. That was my favorite. And then the sixth inning, same thing. Two outs and nobody on. Walk, hit batsman. Walk, walk, grand slam, turn the lights out. It is so frustrating when the Mets give up two-out runs. In this game, they scored 10 runs. 9 of the 10 runs came with two outs. That feels good. That feels good because when it happens to us, it sucks. So it feels good to do it to the other team. And yes, it's the Miami Marlin bullpen. Yes, it's John King and Anthony Bender and Calvin Fauché and Cade Gibson and somebody named Josh White making his major league debut. I understand they did not do this against a murderer's row of bullpen arms. But when you are the New York Mets coming into this game, 8 games under .500, does it really freaking matter who they hit? It does not. On the other side, let's get to Nolan McLain. Nolan McLain is struggling, and I thought his struggles continued on Sunday against the Marlins. The good news is, and this is very good news, is that when Nolan McLain needed to make the biggest pitch, he made it. And that's probably the biggest difference between what happened in this start versus his last two starts. One pitch can make a difference. There's two on, and there's two out in the first inning. He very easily could give up a gapper to make it 2-0 Marlins. He gets a comebacker against Javier Sanoa. Big pitch. Nolan McLain made it. Credit to him. Two outs and nobody on against 8 and 9 of the batting order. He somehow gives up a base hit and a walk to Esteri Ruiz. But when he needs to make a big pitch to a 300 hitter named Xavier Edwards, gets another comebacker. In the fourth inning, walks the very first two guys. Gets bailed out on a great defensive play by A.J. Ewing and gives up an RBI double to Owen Casey. So he is set up in a game now in which it's 3-1. The Marlins have second and third and one out. And again, this is where you do give Nolan McLain credit, makes the big pitch when he needs to. Gets Ruiz to ground out, walks Edwards, gets Liam Hicks to ground out. And then he finished strong with a 1-2-3 fifth inning. He was not dominant. His command was way off. It continues to be an issue. And in this game, it was walks, not just command in terms of falling behind hitters and giving up hittable pitches. No, he put guys on base. He put six guys on base because of his control issues. Five walks and a hit batsman. But you are measured based on the runs you give up. And he made the big pitch when he needed to. So he's struggling. I think that is still a fair description of Nolan McLain, but to his credit, he got through five innings. He threw a million pitches. He was not great. I was encouraged that he pitched a 1-2-3 inning to end his performance, a 1-2-3 inning against 3-4-5 of the batting order. I thought that was at least a nice way to end it. And his next challenge will be against San Diego over the weekend. We'll see if he can at least build off of this. But he wasn't great. This was not a, okay, don't worry, look at Nolan McLain dominate kind of performance. That was not it. Speaking of which, let's read an email from Joe Peters. Joe writes, my hypothesis on my Nolan McLain is struggling is because of Christian Scott. Oh, okay. From April 27th onward, he has pitched behind Scott to the same team every time except twice, if my calculations are right. They have such a similar arsenal, it's like facing the same guy in back-to-back days. Think about it. Sweeper, sinker. Now, McLain does have a curveball, but their arsenal is very similar. I'm starting to wonder, does that have anything to do with it? Now, to be fair and transparent, they did not pitch against the Reds, so that would not explain that outing. But maybe he was just trying to be perfect because he was getting rocked up and he is in his own head because of his prior outings. I'm not saying this is definitely the reason, but it's something I was thinking about. It's an interesting observation, John. And as you self-pointed out, it doesn't explain the Cincinnati game because that was the opener of a series. I have been thinking for a while, I guess 5 days now, that they do need to alter this rotation a little bit, especially with bullpen days being back-to-back. And by bullpen days, we're really talking about Jonah Tong and now Sean Manaea since David Peterson's in the bullpen. You want to split that up. Now, you would want to split that up around guys that can go deep into games. And one of the biggest issues this rotation is facing right now is nobody's going deep into games. It was Nolan McLain, but because of his struggles, and you look at this outing, he goes five, and he was lucky to get through five innings. He's not the innings eater, and it was probably unfair to ever consider him the innings eater. Christian Scott, same thing, and we all know about Freddie. I mean, five-inning Freddie or four-inning Freddie has never gone deep into games. So it's a challenge because it's not like there's somebody you could just stick in the middle who does go deep into games. But your theory on, hey, Scott and McLain are similar, let's split them up, I'm not against trying. I think McLean's issues are that, number one, and I have taken the blame on this a lot whenever we talk about this, he was anointed very quickly and was given unfair expectations. He got off to a great start last year. He was unbelievable. But between pitching the championship game in the WBC, between the way we all talked about him, I was comparing his stats to Seaver and DeGrom just to start careers. And again, I mean, those were stats. It's not like I was making any statement. I wasn't saying he's better than DeGrom or Seaver. It was more, wow, what a start this guy's off to. I think there was this just assumption of, well, he's got it all figured out. He doesn't have it all figured out. He's a young pitcher. Doesn't mean he sucks. Doesn't mean he's never going to put it all together again. Doesn't mean he can't be what we dreamt of him being. But we made a lot of quick assumptions on Nolan McLean. Scott writes, Mark Vientos is not the man right now. I love how passionate people are about that. The I'm the man right now star of the series, which we will hand out. But before we do, Scott wants to tell us why it is not Mark Vientos. I don't care about his offensive numbers. That unbelievably selfish challenge. How many times have we said that precludes Vientos from getting the I'm the man right now award? I genuinely don't think I've ever disliked a player more since his quote, I'll always trust my instincts comment after running through a stop sign. P.S. Say something nice about Jared Young. His return may be the key to turning this season around. I have said plenty of nice things about Jared Young, so we're good. The Vientos challenge. Let's get to that. In the fourth inning of this game, the Mets had already lost a challenge because Luis Torrens had challenged a pitch that was off the plate, trying to steal a strike for Nolan McLean, and it was not called a strike. And so Vientos challenged, and I'll double check it, but I think it was like a 1-1 pitch that was a strike, and Vientos challenged it. And even before we got the result, even before the result came in, I think we're all thinking the same thing, and certainly Gary Cohn has been very critical about it, thinking the same thing, which is this worth it? Like, this is not exactly the situation for you to be challenging. Like, even if you're right, it ain't worth it. So it was a 1-2 pitch, in fairness. It was a 1-2 curveball that touched the top of the strike zone. So the worth it question comes down to this. There's two outs and nobody on in the fourth inning if the call is upheld, and it's 3-1 Mets. If you're right, it's a 2-2 count with one out and nobody on. And the problem is not the score, I guess the inning, but does it change the at-bat? I mean, you're out. You go from out to a 2-2 count. Sure, you're still alive, but there aren't guys on base. It's not a high leverage situation. I know that rallies can come out of nowhere. The Mets showed that with as many two out rallies as they had. But the real question is it worth it? Is the juice worth the squeeze? That's always the question you have to ask yourself with a lot of these challenges. And I think the answer is clearly no, especially when your team only has one left. There needs to be rules about this. And I don't know if teams are doing it. It doesn't feel like Carlos Mendoza is doing it at all. It feels like everyone's got free reign to challenge whenever the hell they want. And so I agree it was a selfish challenge. As far as Mark Vientos' series as a whole, he got big hits in this series. And we could acknowledge that. He ended up 3-for-12 with 2 home runs and 3 RBIs. And all 3 hits felt like they had some kind of value to it. Like the base hit in game 3 of this series led off the second inning, and he eventually scored on Marcus Semien's home run. The 2-run double in the fourth inning of game 2 was arguably one of the biggest hits of this series, maybe outside of the Melendez walk-off. And then he obviously hit that bomb of a home run in the third inning of game 1 that at the time gave the Mets a 5-1 lead, and it felt comfortable, which obviously that lead went away. So Vientos had a good offensive series, but the challenge was bad and the defense wasn't great. He made the miscue behind Freddy Peralta that really shortchanged his start. So credit to Vientos' offense, but yes, I don't think you have anything to worry about, Scott. I am not going to nominate him for the Rico I'm the man right now, but I appreciate the passion. I appreciate you not wanting him to win it. Like, that would be a problem if he did. But hopefully you had a good time this weekend at Citi Field watching the New York Mets if you were there. And if you are there, you know you could celebrate your highlights with Mio Sparkling Sake, a true crowd pleaser, light, bubbly, and easy to enjoy. Whether you're at Citi Field or your favorite spot, ask for Mio Sparkling Sake by name, a new tradition served chilled, imported from Japan, the official sake of Rico Brogna. Enjoy responsibly. Matthew writes, Juan Soto's postgame comments about AJ Ewing and Carson Bench are the best he's had so far as a Met. I really liked his response. Yeah, for those that didn't hear it, Juan Soto basically said that those two guys are psychopaths and that how he leads is not necessarily... Actually, you know what, Hoff, if you don't mind, it's on SNY Mets if you want to tweet it out. I'm not tweeted out. I'm sorry. Play it for us. SNY Mets put out the audio, I'd say about an hour after the game or so, in which Soto talked about his leadership around Carson Bench and AJ Ewing. It is very noticeable. One of the things that we heard so much last year from Met fans, but certainly from non-Met fans, was how it didn't look like Juan Soto was having fun, how he had so much fun with his home run celebrations with Aaron Judge and the Yankees, and he looked so unhappy as a New York Met. And I never made a big deal of it, but we would always acknowledge, like, yeah, it looks very businesslike. And I would always surmise that a lot of it is how he feels at the plate. That the reason he wasn't shimmying and doing the Soto shuffle early last season wasn't because he hated being a Met, but was because he didn't feel comfortable at the plate. There is, and you notice this in spring training, a noticeable difference with Juan Soto. And even his comments in spring training felt very different. He's been shimmying and shuffling since the beginning of the season. And you certainly see, in the case of Bench and Ewing, a different reaction, like a different kind of vibe between them. And Soto seems to have a great relationship with them. And I guess the assumption would be, oh, Soto's the leader. Meanwhile, Soto age-wise is, I don't want to say he's their age, he is older, but he ain't that far off. We forget that Juan Soto is 27 years old. So Hoff, when you have that, give me a holler, if you will, and we'll take a listen to it for those that missed it, because Juan Soto was very interesting in his comments about AJ Ewing and Carson Bench. I can play it through the microphone if that works. In fact, take a listen.
Just, you know, some things, and sometimes we gotta help them, like, you know, to get through it, and it's first time for them being in the big leagues. But at the end of the day, I try to be one of them. I just try to enjoy the moment and have a great time with them.
Yeah, he tries to be one of them, which is interesting. I guess everyone's leadership style is very different. Like, some are the leader, and Juan Soto, and you could kind of tell from his vibe around those guys, he tries to be like them, one of them. And again, it's not that difficult. He isn't that far off in age when you look at Juan Soto and Carson Bench and AJ Ewing. AJ Ewing's defense, because his offense was not great in this series, that's okay. Remember how many at-bats he actually had at AAA? His defense is such a difference. Like, watching Luis Robert Jr. every day versus watching AJ Ewing every day, defensively, not even close. And I don't need a defensive metric to tell me that. Gary Cohn and Ron Darling had a great discussion on the air. We've had it here on the Rico about how defensive metrics are, there's a value to it, especially when you don't watch a guy every day. But when you watch a guy every day, your eye test is a lot better than those metrics. I've said a lot of tough things about Marcus Semien in his time here. I don't regret any of them. They've all been accurate about his struggles. His defense has been good. Like, yeah, I can count on one hand some miscues, the one in Washington. He's had a couple. I'm not saying he's been perfect, but he has mostly been a really good defensive second baseman. For the metrics to say that he's not, I don't know what they're looking at. So I don't need to waste my time looking at the center field metrics on Robert Jr. and Ewing. In fact, I think metrics for Met players are overrated because I'm watching every game. I don't need the goddamn metrics. I see them. They're more important when we talk about acquiring a player or a guy that we don't see every day. Like, for example, and the reason this was talked about was Marlins center fielder Jacob Marcy doesn't have good defensive metrics, and yet when we've seen him play six total games, he looks like freaking Devon White in his prime. My only counter to the broadcast booth on that is we don't watch every Marlin game. Like, we're reacting to how he does against the Mets. Maybe his defense against the Mets has been actually far better than his defense against every other team. That's why when it comes to an opponent, you do have to kind of lean a little bit on the metric, only because we're not seeing the guy every day. Now, it doesn't mean those metrics aren't lying, because I think they're lying about Marcus Semien. Marcus Semien is defensively played very, very well. And I guess that's a nice transition in to the Rico, I'm the man right now. Because Marcus Semien was 5-for-10 in this series, including 2-for-2 in the finale with 2 walks and a home run and 2 RBIs. He ends up driving in 3, hits a home run, has a hit in each game, goes 5-for-10 in this series. He was on base 7 times. Great job by Marcus Semien. I mean, got to give him his due. I know that his numbers have been good this season, great this season, with runners in scoring position, though I have expressed that it doesn't feel that way, even if the numbers are like that, that watching him every day, he hasn't felt like this incredibly clutch hitter. He hasn't felt like a guy that you're begging to have come up with guys on base. But he's the numbers are the numbers. So 5-for-10 with a home run and 3 RBIs. He is an absolute candidate for the Rico, I'm the man right now, star of the series. The other guy I would mention is Carson Bench. Carson Bench gets 3 hits in game 2 of this series. A leadoff single in the first inning. Unfortunately, it didn't lead to anything. A 1-out double in the 5th inning in game 2. Unfortunately, that didn't lead to anything. He did get a double with 1 out and nobody on in the 7th, which did lead to a run. And then in this game, he hits the leadoff home run. Plus, he makes a handful of really good defensive plays. So, good series for Carson Bench. Offensively, very good series for Juan Soto. Had a hit in each game, was on base in each game, hit the grand slam that put this game out of reach. I know that grand slam will be viewed by some as empty calories, as A-Rodian, as tack-on meaningless runs. I guess we'll explore that during the offseason when we do our rating of every Juan Soto home run. But it matters because at 6-1 in the 6th inning, while you feel comfortable, the game is not over. You really don't know. They're asking David Peterson to finish off a Nolan McClain start. We really think like it's not possible the Mets could blow a lead like they did Friday night. So credit to Juan Soto. I know it's not the home run we're waiting for. It's not that bottom of the 9th inning, down by 2-run blast. But nevertheless, a good series for Soto. 4-for-11, a home run, 5 RBIs. We mentioned Vientos, hit 2 home runs in this series. Christian Scott, first major league win, 5 really strong innings. David Peterson pitching 4 scoreless innings after Nolan McClain's start. I think all those guys are fine candidates. I think MJ Melendez, I can't leave him out. I mean, MJ Melendez, it's a game-winning walk-off 2-run home run. And also, in that game, when he came off the bench, had a sacrifice fly that added to a run. So, credit to MJ Melendez as well. Howard likes to chime in on his opinion on the Rico, I'm the man right now, star of the series. He says, it's a close call between Marcus Semien and Juan Soto, but I will go with Semien. He affected winning more despite the slightly better stats for Soto. 5-for-10, 3 runs scored, a key home run, 3 RBIs and solid defense. Juan Soto, 4-for-11, home run, 5 RBIs, not as key home run as Semien. Honorable mention to Christian Scott, Austin Warren. That's a good honorable mention for what he did on Friday. And then even Saturday, so pitched in back-to-back games. Luis Torrens threw a runner out stealing, drove in a bunch of runs. And we mentioned Carson Bench.
Yeah, I'm going to go with MJ Melendez because his home run was significant. It literally won a game. And not trying to say that nobody else was significant with their production, but like it was a commutative effort. Like everyone had a piece of the pie. MJ Melendez literally walked the game off. So if it wasn't for him, we would have won Friday.
How is it not Marcus Semien?
Because again, I think that he was a piece to this series sweep. Same way that Soto was, same way that Bench had some good hits, important hits. I know Marcus Semien had a great weekend. But did he single-handedly win a game?
I mean, you could argue that in Friday's game, when they said that, look, they ended up scoring 9 runs in this game. But if you remember back to let me get the exact inning. It was the 4th inning. And at the time, this game is 5-2. The Marlins just scored a run to make it 5-2. It's only the 4th inning. A lot of time left. He gets a leadoff hit, goes to 2nd on an error by the left fielder. Goes to 3rd on a sacrifice, and the catcher throws the ball into left field. So Marcus Semien was solely responsible, with the help of the Marlins defense, for an important run in Friday's game. In Saturday's game, he gets a double and an RBI single, including driving in the third run of the three-run rally in the fourth inning. And then in Sunday's game, he hits the two-run home run in the second inning that makes it 3-0, and he draws two more walks and got on base four times in this game. I love you, Pete, but you're doing something right now that is not fair, and you know what that is.
I'm not crapping on Semien. I'm not saying that. I'm not poo-pooing what he did.
You are. Like, I've killed Marcus Semien all year. This is not about rehashing the trade or if I believe in him or if you believe in him, but you are having a very difficult time this season, sir, of separating your strong opinions on players with what they did in a specific series. I am not endorsing Marcus Semien for president. I am not buying his jersey. I am merely telling you, which you should admit, that he was the best player on the field in a three-game series. That doesn't mean we love him. It doesn't mean we're wrong about him. But you are sticking to how you feel, and it's clouding your Rico on the man right now.
It's not clouding.
Yes, it is.
MJ Melendez walked off the game. Like, let me put it this way. If MJ Melendez didn't have a walk-off home run on Friday, there's a possibility there's another tailspin this weekend.
A 1,000%. Because after Soto flies out, there's a runner on second and one out. We have no idea where the game goes from there. I get it, and I honorably mention him because he did a walk-off home run, but he didn't even start the next game nor play in game two of this series. And then in game three, he came in for garbage time and had a meaningless at-bat. So when you sweep a three-game series, I don't know. Maybe it's the guy who was involved in all three games and not the guy involved in one of the games.
Yeah, but you know what? He may be DFA'd next week, so this might be the last time we talk about MJ Melendez.
Now, there is a possibility he goes down with Jorge Polanco on his way back. The net negative. Now, I'll read who Howard suggested in his email. He mentioned Tobias Myers for the two-run home run that almost cost game one. Obviously blew that game in the eighth inning and then got sent down. And Bo Bichette had another just bad offensive weekend. He went 1-for-10 in total. He did score two runs in game one. He drew a walk with the bases loaded in game three. But a very non-impactful weekend for Bo Bichette. But I'm telling you right now, and you're going to really have a tough time talking me out of it, the net negative is not Bo Bichette. The net negative is not Tobias Myers. The net negative, the guy who impacted this weekend in a major way that we are still feeling the ramifications of. And I know when you sweep a series, there should be no negative. Bull bleep. Do you know who I'm talking about right now, Pete? Do you have any idea who I think should be the net negative? And I would defy anybody to talk me out of it.
No, I want to say Mark Vientas, but it's not him.
No. The net negative of this three-game series is Freddie Peralta.
Oh.
Because Freddie Peralta's inability with a 4-0 lead to get through five innings cost so much of this bullpen and impacted Tobias Myers even being on the freaking roster right now.
Yeah.
Like, if Freddie Peralta did what he should do, which is, hey, I got a 4-0 lead, six innings, two runs, Tobias Myers may not get into that game. And if Tobias Myers doesn't get into that game, he doesn't get sent down. And you end up using guys that you don't want to use. Brooks Raley was not supposed to pitch in this game, and he did. Now, good news, it didn't end up affecting game two of this series because Cyanel Perez did a great job out of absolute nowhere, and the Met offense was able to tack on enough runs late. And then in the finale of this series, credit to David Peterson, who I guess in a weird way deserves a little bit of honorable mention for the four scoreless innings he threw, backing up Nolan McClain. But Freddie Peralta effed with this bullpen in a huge way this weekend. And for a guy that's supposed to be an ace, and for a guy they rely on to at least, I'm not even saying go deep into games, he pitched 4 2/3 innings. And I know Mark Vientos' defense certainly didn't help him on the two out, should have been an inning-ending grounder off the bat of Otto Lopez. But I think the ramifications of Freddie Peralta's performance was felt all weekend long, and that is the true definition, even in the sweep, of the net negative.
No, I'll give it to you. Tobias Myers definitely felt the wrath of this. And it's disappointing because I thought he's done rather well. I know if you go through his last like six outings, I think he's given up like a run per game, which is not great. But again, like he's getting used inappropriately, in my opinion, and he was, should not have been pitched on Friday. That was not a spot for Tobias Myers to be pitching on Friday. And to be sent down is ridiculous because he's been – I thought he's done rather well pretty much all season long up until this point recently.
They needed another body, right? So we all agree that because of the Peralta outing, they needed another body. Who are you getting rid of if it wasn't Tobias Myers? This is the problem with this whole thing. It's where, as frustrating as Myers being sent down, I'll ask him. Mean, I'll give you the options just in case you forgot. You could release Sean Manaea, who's now entering the rotation, or at least sort of the rotation. You could release AJ Minter. You could release Brooks Raley. Obviously, those are not real options. You could release Luke Weaver, not a real option. You could release Devin Williams, not a real option. You could send down Austin Warren, who's been great. You want to send Austin Warren down?
Nah, I would have gotten rid of David Peterson.
Yeah, I mean, you could release guys who still have important roles on this team who we're done with, sure, but this is a move for a few days. Like, you're trying to fix your pen and get a fresh arm for a few days. You're not making the decision to release David Peterson or Sean Manaea based on that. You're releasing them because you're done with them. And if that's the decision you make, that's the decision you make. You're not doing it to get add yourself a fresh arm. You're sending somebody down. So your real options were Austin Warren, Waskar Brazoban, and Tobias Myers. Those are your or Jonah Tong. But Jonah Tong has a role. He's going to have to pitch in a couple of days. So, like, you could have, and I'm not kidding, you could have done that. You could have sent Jonah Tong down and then brought up the fresh arm. And then whenever Tong was going to be the bulk starter, you could have called someone else to do it. Like, it just wouldn't have been Jonah Tong because of the rule that once you're sent down, you got to wait 2 weeks. But that's not ideal either. So, unfortunately, they didn't have any other options. Hence why Freddy Peralta's the net negative, because he's the one that created this entire mess. I'm telling you right now, I don't know if I've ever come into a Rico more passionate about a net negative than the Freddy Peralta one, because to me, his impact was felt all weekend long. All weekend long, we had to deal with this crap because he couldn't go five innings.
Evan, are you sure you're not letting your hate for the player, make this the net negative, rule your decision?
I don't hate the player.
Oh, okay.
That's the difference. Jordan writes, the Mets are cruel and sadistic. I'm writing this immediately after the Juan Soto Grand Slam. What business did the Mets have giving the fans hope? Again, this team is just cruel and sadistic. Christopher writes, Chris from Alabama, I don't know about you, Evan, but I'm starting to see some green shoots.
Oh, Jesus.
Keep going, line.
Do you want that Soto audio, by the way?
I already played it through my phone. You want to hear it clearer this time?
Oh, no, it's fine.
I don't know how clear that sounds when I do that, but I wanted to just do it, so I apologize. If you want to play it again, for those that missed it, do you have it ready?
I have it.
All right, ladies and gentlemen, Juan Soto after the game and talking about his leadership around the young outfielders Carson Benj and A.J. Ewing.
A.J. and Carson have made in the outfield.
they're great, man. They're great. They call each other a psychopath, and I'm like, yeah, you guys are. I mean, it's just crazy how hard they go into the wall or running around the field. It's incredible. It's really fun to watch.
How much are you enjoying just kind of being like a mentor to them?
I don't try to be a mentor. I try to be one of them, you know. I try to make them feel like they are part of this. They are the same as me. They have the same voice. They just, you know, some things that sometimes we got to help them, like, you know, to get through it. And it's first time for them being in the big leagues. But at the end of the day, I try to be one of them. I just try to enjoy the moment and have a great time with them.
The leadership of Juan Soto. This is from Matt. Matt writes, hi, I'm Matt from Connecticut. First time contributor to the podcast, mailbag. Thank you. And Hoff for covering the Mets so intently all year long. I'm writing this in the bottom of the sixth inning, two outs, bases loaded, Bo Bichette at the plate with the opportunity to break this game open. Let's see if he can. I was wondering two things. Did you hear Gary and Ronnie, while briefly discussing the Knicks in the finals and New York City needing a championship, shout out your Nets fandom as the only fan of the team they could identify? Yes, I did hear that. I was watching this guy. I did not go to the Sunday game. I was on my deck with my family, just chilling. And Ron Darling, I'm going to play this on Evan and Tiki on Monday, so I'll describe it here, and then I'll play it on Monday. But Ron Darling talked about how, even though he's not a New Yorker, didn't grow up here, he will root for New York teams to win a championship. And now that the Knicks are in the NBA Finals, he will watch the NBA Finals while rooting for the Knicks, which was a fine statement. Like, as much as I want to get away from the Knicks when I'm watching the Mets, I get it. I understand it. This is the talk of the town. Respect. Gary Cohen, for no reason whatsoever, instead of saying, yeah, he just says, did you watch the Nets in the finals? And as soon as he said that, I'm like, why are you bringing that up? The Nets haven't been in the finals since 2003, and they played in New Jersey. He's talking about a New York team, so he could even get literal. But whatever. He brings that up. Again, as a poor Net fan, I'm facing shrapnel. And then Ronnie says, no. And then Gary says, do you even know a Nets fan? And as he says that, I'm actually thinking of a story I have with Ron Darling, which I'm not really sure he remembers, but way back when, my first full year at WFAN, full time, I was doing my Saturday show, and it was in the midst of Mets Yankees. So Ron Darling was my co-host. I was doing the Saturday show with Ron Darling in the middle of Mets Yankees, but it was also in the middle of Nets Cleveland Cavaliers. In fact, the Nets just lost game 6 of the Eastern Conference semifinals to get eliminated. Now, I understand. Mets Yankees was the story, and we did all Mets Yankees. But I said to Ronnie during one of the breaks, I just need 5 minutes on this Nets-Cavs game. And Ron's like, of course. No, I totally get it. And I lost my mind screaming about the way Vince Carter performed in the fourth quarter of game 6 between the Nets and the Cavs. And so Ronnie was like, his mouth was open, like, oh my God, this guy's pissed. I didn't know a Net fan existed. So I was not surprised that when Gary Cohen said, do you know any Net fan, that Gary and Ronnie would shout me out, not as an honor, but as I'm the only animal they know who roots for the Nets. So it wasn't even a shout out. It was more like embarrassment. Like, I can't name anybody else. That guy. So yeah, I can't get away from this Nick run. Now, obviously, I do it for a living and I talk about it with a smile on my face. But when I'm watching the Mets, I want to get away from it. And I never can. And now I'm getting shrapnel about how the Nets have no fans. We have nothing to do with this. The Nets, I keep being told the Nets are irrelevant. Then why do I keep facing shrapnel? I don't want any of it. Anyhow, Matt continued his email by saying, secondly, as Bo Bichette drew a walk to bring in the sixth run and bring Juan Soto up to the plate against a debuting Marlins rookie, does this grand slam he just crushed to ice this imperative reverse sweep of the Marlins count as clutch by Soto in your opinion? Invested or interested in your analysis based on the ongoing dialogue about his home run timing? I do consider it relatively clutch because, like I said before, it's a 6-1 game in the sixth inning. We know David Peterson is shutting the door. We have the utmost confidence that David Peterson is allowing that 6-1 lead to hold up. So yeah, I would give it a level of clutch. Now, where do the Mets go from here? That's the real big question as they begin yet another West Coast trip. They have been on so many to begin this season. It continues again in Seattle against the Mariners with 3 games against a Mariner team that is playing a lot better than 3 games in San Diego against the Padres. I mentioned this a few weeks ago. The Mets have been involved in a soft schedule for a long time now, really going back to when they finished up the Dodger Cub Road trip back in the middle of April. When they got home after that trip, and that, of course, was in the midst of their losing streak. Their losing streak had reached 11 after they got swept in Chicago. They had dropped to an ungodly 7-15. We looked at their homestand against Minnesota and Colorado and even their road trip with Anaheim and Colorado as an opportunity to get better because they were facing a lot of bad teams, a lot of mediocre teams. So that stretch began at 7-15. Well, they've come out of that stretch where they have faced mostly bad teams with a record of 26-33. So let me do some quick math on this. That means they have lost 18 times, and that means they have won 19 times. Okay, so 19-18 since that moment. And unfortunately, that's not good enough. It doesn't feel like it's good enough. I mean, other than the Yankees, they have played nothing but mediocre to bad teams since the middle of April, and they posted a 19-18 record. They needed to be better than that. If we could have gone back in a time machine and you could have asked me in the midst of this 11-game losing streak at the time, schedule's about to get soft, what do they got to do in these next 37 games? I probably would have said they need to be, I got to do math again, crap, 6 or 7 games above 500, something of that nature. And instead, they basically were a 500 team. They are now about to begin the opposite. They're about to play 3 in Seattle, 3 in San Diego. Those are two teams that, as of right now, have pretty damn good records. The Mariners are slowly getting above 500, so their record is not that good, but we know that they're better than the start they got off to. They are currently on a 6-game winning streak. So they're playing well. The San Diego Padres currently are 32-26. So two teams above 500. Then they play the Cardinals, 4 games above 500. Then they play the Braves, 20 games above 500. Then they play the Cincinnati Reds, 2 games above 500. The Phillies, 1 game above 500. The Cubbies, 5 games above 500. The Phillies again, 1 game above 500. The Toronto Blue Jays, who at the time right now are 2 games under 500, but I think we assume they're better. And then the Atlanta Braves. They are playing nothing but good to really good teams until July 7th. So I look at this stretch of games and I say, can they survive this? Is this where they go backwards again? Or are they actually going to cut into the deficit they created? And that is a part of why I don't sit here on episode 701 of the Rico, coming off a sweep of the Marlins, talking this team up like good things are about to happen. First of all, no one goes deep in this rotation. They've got holes coming up in Seattle, in which Carlos Mendoza said game one's going to be a bullpen day, whatever that means. Shawmaniah Jonatang will play an impact over the first two games of this series, and then they'll wrap it up with Freddy Peralta on Thursday or Wednesday afternoon. God knows if he goes more than five. So the rotation is not set up brilliantly or perfectly. We'll see what Nolan McClain does as he tries to continue to rework his season against the Padres. And the offense has been encouraging. That's certainly a positive over the last few days against Miami, but do we all of a sudden think this offense is going to carry them over the course of the next few weeks? So this is going to be tough, and I'm not going to, you know, paint your rainbows right now. I am fearful that things are going to get ugly on this West Coast trip, and things are going to get ugly during this stretch of games. Can they be 5 games under 500 when this whole thing is said and done? Like this stretch of baseball that I just described? Let me count the games up. 6, 9, 12, 15, 18, 22, 25, 28, 32. It is 32 games that they are about to embark on against good competition. I'm being honest with you and telling you, I think 16-16, you'd almost have to be thrilled with. Now, that still leaves them 7 games under 500 in early July. I mean, does that, are they in a race? Probably not. Like, I don't know if that's even good enough. But against this kind of competition, I don't really have that much faith in more. Now, you want to tell me, Ev, can they go 20-16 during that stretch? And that would at least get them to 3 games under 500? I think that'd be a wild success. You go into that series against Kansas City and Boston, those final 6 games before the All-Star break, 3 games under 500 with a chance to get to 500. I think that would be probably the best case scenario. But I worry. I worry because I am not delusional enough to think that this sweep against Miami is really going to catapult them to some kind of 15-18 stretch. This is going to be very tough. The Seattle series is going to be really tough. But let's take it a series at a time or a trip at a time. I think if you can survive this by going 3-3 against Seattle and San Diego, I would take that as a success. And then you come home against St. Louis and Atlanta, and you hope you could at least cut into the deficit then. But that's my fear as we look ahead to Seattle. Jorge Polanco may be on his way back. It appears that the San Diego series could be when Polanco's back. In terms of how I would play him, here's how I would handle things. I think the odd man out as of right now would be MJ Melendez. There's a part of me that would want to send Brujan down, but it leaves them without a backup shortstop. And so you're asking Bo Bichette and Brett Beatty and Marcus Semien. I mean, I guess if Polanco could play first and you've got Vientos shifting to third, which I don't think any of us really want to see, your emergency plan could be Brett Beatty at shortstop, or dare I say Marcus Semien playing shortstop for a few innings. Like, they could treat this the way they did at times Lindor last year, where there is no backup shortstop. Like, in the middle of a game, you'd have someone who's not a shortstop shift over. But then if there's an injury, you just make the move the next day. You bring up a real shortstop the next day. I say that because Brujan has no role on this team. Like, Brujan's only role is garbage time. You know, we saw him get a start the other day because they just rarely gave Brett Beatty an off day. But for the most part, Vidal Brujan has barely played. So you could keep Melendez up here, get creative with the backup shortstop job, and send out Vidal Brujan. But I think if you don't, the odd man out is MJ Melendez. I think Jared Young's got to stay. I think Eric Wagaman's got to stay, as crazy as that is. You know, he's your right-handed bat off the bench. But, of course, he's the other guy you could send out for Jorge Polanco. But I think as we sit here right now, I'm more intrigued by sending out Brujan and just dealing with that backup shortstop if there's an injury for a few innings. And then if there's an injury that's more than that, you know, you call someone up the next day. Not unheard of. Something they've done before. But I think when Polanco comes back, he should mostly DH. This is still a guy that's only played two games at first base. And they were the first two games of the season. Like, that's it. We haven't seen him play first base. I think Jared Young and Mark Vientos, for now, are your first baseman. And I think Polanco kind of serves in that DH role. But I hope he comes back. I mean, he's one of those guys where they could use him. They could use another bat. That DH spot has kind of been that one spot in the order that you look at and say, all right, where am I getting production from? So hopefully he does come back, and hopefully he contributes. But it's going to be a challenge over the next week as they go to Seattle and San Diego. And good news, Met fans, this is it for late starts. That's it. They got a couple of 940s in Seattle, a 940 in San Diego, a 10 o'clock on Saturday, and then that's it. Like, all their late games are 7:30, 7:40. I think there's one 8 o'clock game mixed in there. So that's the good news, right? And it's going to train your body because you're going to stay up late for the Knicks in the NBA Finals anyway. So hopefully the Mets can build off of this. I don't want to end the Rico on such a negative note, but I always try to keep it real. This is going to be tough, and this is going to be a challenge. We appreciate you downloading episode 701 of the Rico. I always tell you, subscribe so you never miss an episode. We always give you Ricos at the end of each series. That's a guarantee. But we mix in some instant reactions. You never know. Me and Hoff staying up late on a Monday night and a Tuesday night. You may get a West Coast late night Rico. So be ready. Thank you very much for hanging out with us on another edition of Rico Bronya.